Right now we are talking science because Dr. Carl has wandered in and he is ready to use his brain for good and not evil. Good morning, Carl.
Good morning. That sounds like a wonderful description of a life career path.
You've done well with yourself and for yourself and for everyone else. Let's share the knowledge this morning. If you've got a question, give us a call, 1-300-055-36. If you can't get through but you've got an answer or a comment, we always love hearing from you, and there's a couple of ways that you can do that. Text us on 0439 75 7555. That's a Triple J text line. Or you can tweet Dr. Carl direct at Dr. Carl on Twitter. That's DOCTORKARL. Let's jump into it. We're going to go highbrow for the very first question. Luke is calling in from Byron. Hey, Luke.
Morning, doctors.
Good morning, Luke. You are sounding very sprightly.
Oh, you know how it is. Thursday, it's that close to Friday.
It's true. What's your question for Carl?
Right. It's about poo.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
Good start of the day, yep.
The boy, we went for a bit of a boys' trip on the weekend, and me mate, we won't use his real name, we'll call him James, had to go to the toilet. So in the creek he went, and he's done his business, and it's come to the surface up like a Mr. Whippy, and half of it's kept floating, and half of it's broke off and sank. And we'd like to know why.
Amazing descriptive term. Come to the surface like a Mr. Whippy.
Wow.
Yeah, come up and touch his back too. It was great.
Good idea, James.
Wouldn't it have been better to actually have a poo on the side and then just use the then get some water and splash it on yourself so that way you wouldn't contaminate the water downstream?
Yeah, but I don't think he was thinking too much about that. He just had to go. Hey, when you got to go, Dr. Carl, you got
to
go.
Yeah, but you don't have to affect somebody else with water poisoning downstream. Anyway, now that I've had my moral message out of the way, and by the way, one of the greatest discoveries of the 19th and 20th centuries was that you do not poo in streams and you do not drink poo water. And in Bali, in Indonesia, they do not know that. And people will dump their feces into a river and knowing that their sister or brother lives in a village 1 kilometre downland and they don't see the relationship between that and diseases they get. Now that I've done enough moral mucking around, there's a thing called the Bristol Scale. I think it begins either with the letter B or M, and it rates the floatiness of poo. And so when I was working in gastro as a medical doctor, this is one of my favourite areas because you can make your diagnosis in about 60-70% of cases just by asking the patient the right questions, and then another 20% or so by just laying your hands on them, and you only need to go to fancy investigations for 10%. I would always ask them whether their poo floated, and most of them would say, I don't know, I never looked. And what makes it float is higher fat content in general or higher fiber content. And what makes it sink is lack of those things. So he could have had a mixed diet, and so the poo wasn't all homogenised and mashed up. It was in different layers.
What's healthy to have, a floater or a sinker?
In general, floaters are better. In general, that implies a short transit time. And the way they work out the transit time of food is they get you to swallow little tiny plastic coloured shapes, red, green, blue, triangle, sphere, et cetera, et cetera, and see when they come out. And the transit time ranges from about 12 hours up to 36, 40, and you want a shorter transit time and you want lots of fibre for a healthy gut, and that implies that then your diet is such that you're less likely to come down with mature age diabetes.
Hey, thanks for the question, Luke.
Thank you, Dr. Luke. Sorry for picking on you.
Corn is also a good transit time thing, isn't it? Because you don't digest corn. Why is that?
Because you don't chew it. If you chew it, it doesn't magically reconstitute itself. You got to chew every single bit. I know it's hard.
Life is hard.
Life is hard. You got to chew your food. God damn. Why don't they chew it for me like they did when I was a baby?
We've got another question about food from Simone in Bega. Hi, Simone.
Hi, Simone. Welcome.
Hello. How are you going?
Very well, thanks. What's your question?
It's happened to me a couple of times, and it happened to me again the other day. The first couple of times it's happened, it's been when I've been eating like a really, really good Thai green curry, so like super spicy. Sometimes while I'm eating it, all of a sudden I just get a violent case of the hiccups.
Really?
Yeah, and I've only noticed that it sort of happens with spicy food. The other day I had a soup and I laced it with white pepper.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was eating it, all of a sudden the hiccups came on again. And they seem to sort of resolve for the most part by themselves.
That's
good. Sometimes, when I've had like a Thai green curry, something really, really hot, you get hiccups and they can be so violent that you think, am I going to be one of those people that have hiccups for the rest of their lives, you know?
And would they be maybe once every couple of seconds or so, the hiccups? Or every second?
Yeah, they're really sort of frequent, like sort of short intervals between them.
And are they powerful hiccups?
Yes.
Oh, dear. And how long does it take for them to resolve in your case?
Oh, not very long. Not very long for the most part.
Ah, so the way that hiccups happen is that there is a putative guest. So we have reason to believe, we haven't proven it, that there is a hiccup center in the brain.
Yep.
In the brain stem, not far from the medulla oblongata. And a hiccup is not just randomness, but it's a very tightly coordinated series of events where air is drawn into your lungs, and then after 35 milliseconds, suddenly the vocal cords just snap shut.
Okay.
So the diaphragm muscle is a curved muscle. It separates your lungs from your gut. It's at the bottom of your rib cage. And so when it contracts, it goes straight. And above it are lungs, and if your mouth and nose happens to be open, air will then, the lungs will get bigger and air will come in. 35 milliseconds, suddenly, and we don't know why, a signal is sent to the larynx saying, shut the vocal cords, and you get this hic noise.
Yes.
From your point of view, we know it's happening, we don't know why. I'm sorry.
Okay. That's okay.
Nor do we know where this centre is for sure, sorry.
I have heard this before, though. We'll see if anybody else can shed some light for us. Thanks for the call, Simone.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's head to Carlos, who's calling in from beautiful Catherine this morning. Hey, Carlos.
Hey, how you going?
Very well. How hot is that up there today?
Oh, I've got my sweat on, that's for sure.
Which is perfect because you've got a sweat-related question for us. What's your question?
Now what Carlos just said is spelt L-T-O-I-T-E.
What?
It is an ironic, sarcastic comment.
What, got my sweat on?
Yeah, well,
it's hot. It's literal.
Oh, it's literal. So it's not an ironic. That killed me in a crossword yesterday. L T O I T E. So you've just won the lottery, and people say, "Hey, going?" You say, "Oh, all right, could be better."
Yeah, right.
You're right. Okay. So is it okay? Go on, Carl. Sorry to interrupt.
You're all right, mate. I was just wondering, how does sweat actually cool you down? Because I would have thought the reaction of the wind blowing across the sweat would cause friction, which should make it hotter.
That is, you are absolutely correct. However, you need a lot of wind velocity to do that. So in your standard subsonic plane, like your 737 Airbus, Boeing, whatever, the skin temperature on the plane will be about 40 degrees hotter than the outside air temperature. And that's traveling at about 700 kilometres per hour, or 700 to 900. If you're doing over 3,000 kilometres per hour, as in the Lockheed SR-71, not been in the front seat twice, and it flies so high that the earth is curved and the sky is black, the outside temperature at 70,000 feet is, I'm guessing, minus 100. The skin temperature is plus 400 C.
Right.
But these are massive wind velocities. With the wind velocities that we get of 100 kilometres per hour, 50, you're not getting any effective warming. But instead, you're getting the wind going over the sweat and then removing the more energetic molecules, leaving behind a bunch of molecules that have a lower average temperature.
Hey, thanks for the call, Carlos.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You, Dr. Carlos.
Keep it keel in Catherine as well.
Whoa.
1-300-0555-536.
Nicely done, mate.
We're talking science right now with Dr. Carl. 1-300-0555-536 is the number if you've got a question for us. Leighton does in Sydney. Hey, Leighton.
Hi,
G'day,
Dr. Leighton.
How are you going?
Good. What's your question?
Every time I drink alcoholic cider, I get really bad indigestion or an earache. Funny thing, it actually happens if I eat avocado as well. So I'm not too sure if there's something in both of those products that is causing it, or I'm just weird.
And how long does the earache last for?
For probably about half an hour or so, but it comes on, starts as a sort of an indigestion sort of in the throat, and then it sort of goes through, and then it sort of turns into an earache. Probably about half an hour to 45 minutes in total.
And how long does it take to come on after you eat?
I don't eat avocado too much. I'm not that fond of it, but I know it does happen as well. But the main thing is whenever I drink a cider, say I'm halfway through a 300ml bottle, it starts coming on straight away. But it doesn't happen with normal cider. It's not alcoholic. So I don't know if it's something to do with the alcohol as well.
Mm.
Ah, so like it comes on after about 10 minutes or 15 minutes
Yeah,
or so.
About 10 minutes. I just start to get really bad indigestion from it.
And both ears?
The ears come on sort of after. They don't happen all the time, but it's mainly indigestion starts, and then when it's a really bad case, that's when the earache comes on to sort of finish it off.
All I can think of is the vagus nerve, and associated with your brain, you have 12 cranial, brainal nerves, and number 10 is the vagus nerve, so-called because it wanders not just in the skull but outside the skull. And it goes down to your airways, to your lungs, to your heart, and to your gun, and to your gut, and all the way down to your anus at the back end. And it's also associated, all I can think of here is a link with the so-called Alderman's nerve or Arnold's nerve. So this is part of the vagus nerve, and it affects the ear, and so people can have pain in the ear via the vagus nerve, the pain in the ear and behind the ear. And all I'm thinking is that there's some way the vagus nerve is being tickled because it goes into your gut, and then this causes a reaction. But why did it decide to go to the ear via the Alderman's nerve or the Arnold's nerve? No idea. It's a mystery. But it's a fascinating one.
Okay. Well, look, I guess it's just going to have to keep happening if I keep drinking the stuff. But,
have you been to the doctor, Leighton?
Look, I thought it was probably a bit of a waste of time going to the doctor complaining about drinking alcohol and getting a...
So you thought you'd call us instead?
I thought I'd call you guys instead.
No,
thanks for wasting our time.
Go to the doc. There might be... it could be a link of something else. It could be a harbinger of something else.
As with every question that's quite specific, I would recommend going to a GP. Thanks for the call, Leighton.
What she says.
Thanks a lot, Doctor.
Thank you, Dr. Leighton.
Cheeky. Speaking of cheeky, we have got a call from Alex in Sydney. I believe his surname is Dyson. You may recognise him as one of the hosts of Triple J Breakfast, but this morning he is a science caller. Good morning, Daiso.
Hey, Zan. Hey, Dr. Carl. How are we?
Hi, Dr. Daiso. Nice to see you.
What's your question?
Now, Zan, you're dishing out the waste of time comments. I don't know if I want to be...
it's real talk.
I want to ask a question now, just in case.
Real talk. What's your question?
Well, I was going to ask you, Dr. Carl. I thought about this question, witnessing a bird defecating and hearing that they do it in a single motion, both their solids and liquids in the one go.
Mm-hmm.
We, of course, have liquids and solids separate. I was wondering if there were any evolutionary benefits to doing it that way rather than in the one system.
Mm.
Ah, the birds, and by the way, birds are dinosaurs that never got wiped out as a result of the big rock 65 million years ago. Birds have a single opening for everything called, literally in Latin, a sewer, or it's called a cloaca, C-L-O-A-C-A. So that's for defecation, urination and sex. Mm. What's the evolutionary advantage? My straight answer is I don't know without thinking about it. There would be an article on it somewhere. I haven't read that article. If somebody could ring in and point us to it, and hopefully we'll get an answer for you, there would be...
Are we able to reap more vitamins out of it if we get the liquid side of things and the solid side of things? I don't know.
No, the birds have gone to the trouble of having hollow bones, and they've minimized for lack of weight or low weight, and some birds even have minimized things so much that they add on extra brain to attract a female so they can have sex with them, and as soon as they've successfully had sex, they lose a bit of the brain and then go stupid. Yeah. So weight is really critical. So it might be related to that. I'm not an evolutionary biologist dealing with birds, so I'll have to just say I don't know, Dr. Alex.
Maybe some ornithologists are listening and we can
An ornithologist with an evolutionary biology bent.
Very specific. Hey, yeah. Daiso, you're going to be asking me questions in about an hour and a half as well, aren't you?
Yeah, looking forward to it, Zan, our Google Hangout. I'll be doing your job and you are the Dr. Zan that people can ask questions of, not necessarily scientific ones, but, yeah, anything that they want to know about Zan Rowe, that'll be happening at 1.
Yep, we're going to be doing that online. So if you are near a computer at 1 o'clock, just go to the ABC homepage, abc.net.au. You and ask your questions with the hashtag AskZan, and I will be answering them for you. I'll see you then, Daiso.
Catch you then.
Thanks for the call. Let's head to Gladstone where Doug's on the phone. Hey, Doug.
Good morning, doctors. How are we?
Very well. What's your question?
I'm currently growing a moustache for Movember, and I was just wondering if there's anything I can do to make it grow faster.
No. What you can do, however, is dehydrate yourself so your skin will shrink away. This happens to people when they're dead and thus giving the impression that the hair still keeps on growing after they're dead.
Don't recommend that, though.
Don't recommend that at all. Can't think of anything else other than going along with little tweezers one by one and pulling the little buggers out and then gluing them back in with super glue. Don't recommend that either, too. Haven't got any good suggestions. What about number three?
Does hair grow faster in colder climates? If you were to shift up to the northern hemisphere for Movember, would your hair grow faster?
Don't know. And also, would human growth hormone make it grow faster?
Don't do that either.
Don't do that either. your teeth will all come loose.
I think you just got to ride with your what God gave you, Doug. What you were born with.
go with the flow.
Good luck though through November.
Testosterone might help. Wouldn't recommend that either.
Thanks for the call, Doug.
Thank you, Dr. Doug. Right, sorry.
We're going to head next to Tony, who's calling in from Tweed. Hello, Tony.
Hi, Tony.
Hello, doctors.
What's your question?
I wanted to ask Doctor about Comet Ison.
And what
he thinks might happen later next month.
It's going to make its point of closest approach to the sun, about 1.5 kilometres from the surface on the 25th of November. And then in later January, it'll make its point of closest approach to the Earth and probably won't have a meteor shower associated with it. And in fact, the astronomer Carl Battams, I'm quoting from the Wikipedia homepage, said in July 2013, few serious astronomers and cometary scientists have ever felt that ISON, International Scientific Optical Network, that Comet ISON would be brighter than the full moon. Nobody thought that. That's entirely the media's term, and we've been saying this for months. None of us in this Comet ISON observing campaign foreseeing ISON getting that bright and have never done so. But remember this, comets are like cats. They do whatever they want. It could flare up, but certainly I'd give it a go. I remember when Comet McNaught came through, you could go to Watson's Gap outside of Sydney and look back over the city and see it. And one of the major newspapers had published an article saying that it wasn't there. And I could see it, the length of the city, five times the size of the full moon.
Oh, wow.
And I rang up the newspaper and I said, look, I can see it. And they said, no, it's not there. I said, I can see it with my naked eye. And they say, no, mate, that was yesterday's news. And so most people in Sydney didn't bother looking at sunset to see it. And all I had to do was just go out and look to the west and they would have seen this thing. And I've made it my point to tell everybody. I said, but the paper said it wasn't there. No, I'll just show you now. There it is.
You were probably having a party, weren't you?
Yeah, everywhere. I even took my image stabilized binoculars so people could glory in it even more. Give it a go, Dr.
Sorry,
Tony.
Did you say we were going to actually see it or not?
Maybe. At this stage,
we don't really know, do we?
We don't know. Follow the ice on site, but actually go out and follow the ice on site and go and look where they tell you to look, especially when dark adapted. It's a nice warm time of year in Australia in the southern hemisphere. We might be lucky that you can have a nice night having a cup of tea and watching it after the sun goes down.
It's worth taking your eyes off the screen or the television and looking up to see if you can see it. Thanks for the call, Tony. Hey, Jay.
Hey, guys. I was just wondering why it is that preceding a migraine headache, you get that horrible, swirly, just awful vision thing going on.
It's poorly understood, but we're thinking of something like uncontrolled electrical waves running through the brain. And it's a bit like pouring water, conductive water, into an electrical device such as a radio or a TV, and then suddenly the electricity is going where it's not wanted. The vision centres, Brodmann's areas 17, 18 and 19 at the back of your head, basically set on each side, and they're basically the size of a baby's clenched fists. And so if some of the waves go through there, they could accidentally set off electrical stimulation and then you get these flashing lights. Another way of getting it, which I do not recommend, is getting bumped on the head, and when the brain hits the skull, the mechanical stimulation causes electrical release, and so then you end up with the lights. Why does he get it from migraine? We really don't know, but that's the best theory, sort of uncontrolled electrical activity.
Righto, thanks very
Sorry
much.
Sorry about
thanks,
that.
Jay.
Thank you.
Let's head to Newey, where Ben's on the line. Hey, Ben.
G'day, how are you guys?
Very well. What's your question?
I've just noticed, when I've been slapping the sausage in the shower and I ejaculate, why does my semen turn into like a thick, gluey paste?
Amazing presentation of a question. What's the answer, scientifically?
Don't know. How about that? I'll have to go chasing that one up. If anybody's got an answer, they can point it to a peer-reviewed paper, which gives us a good answer, probably from IVF land. Go to DOCTORKARL for Twitter, or even ring in on the plain old POTS or plain old telephone system.
Sorry, we couldn't help you out, Ben. Thanks for the question.
No, something I've worried about myself as well. We need to know.
That's oversharing. The other end of that, if you do that but with someone else, then you become pregnant, which leads to our next question from Jess. That's my bad idea of a segue. Good morning, Jess.
Hello, Dr. Jess.
Good morning.
Welcome.
That was gross.
I know. And boys smell bad too.
Yeah, boys are the worst.
Yeah.
You're calling in from Melbourne. What's your question?
Yeah, Dr. Carl, I'm pregnant, obviously, and I've just been looking into probiotics during pregnancy, and I've come across the New Zealand study that showed a 6 billion daily dose of Lactobacillus rhamnosus show while you're 32 weeks pregnant and onwards, and while breastfeeding showed to reduce the risk of the babies developing allergies like eczema and hay fever by 44%.
Was that paper in a peer-reviewed scientific journal?
Yeah.
What journal?
Wiccans.
Wiccans?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Wiccans or something. I'm not.
Wiccans doesn't sound like a scientific journal to me. It sounds like people who run around at night worshipping pagan things on a full moon. Is that Wiccan?
No. It was done by an Otago University in Otago.
Right. Okay. And then you've got to read the follow-up on that.
Yeah, the follow-up has just come out, so they're now all 6 years old, and it's like thousands and thousands of babies, and that's what they found.
Really?
So I just wanted to know, yeah.
I'd have to read the original paper, but I would get that paper, print it off, and then take it to your ONG person. Are you going through an ONG person?
Yeah.
Okay, and then ask their opinion on it. In general, I would tend to say it's probably not necessary. It's extra money for somebody. You're probably going to be just perfectly fine. But if something like this can specifically reduce the incidence of allergies further down the line, and you're saying 30%, that's an amazingly high number.
44%. I mean, I was a baby with a lot of allergies when I was a kid. I grew out of them. But, you know, they're so prevalent in kids today. And you just don't know. I'm thinking, like, I don't know if I've got the right bacteria in my vagina to pass on.
If you could go to my Twitter homepage and post any information about the paper, I can go chasing it up myself.
Oh,
and also, check with your ONG person. And if you do it for me, I can then give you an answer, but it'll take me 2 hours to read it.
Yeah, no worries.
Thanks, Jess.
Wow.
Thank you.
Just going back to the semen question, we've had an abundance of responses on the text line, which I'm not surprised about. Thank you for everyone who's texting 0439757555. A few responses. He's cooked his semen.
Yep,
the hot
I got
shower.
That one too. Cooking the proteins resulting in a change of texture, yep.
Josh in St Kilda says, I would think the hot water of the shower would cook the protein out of the ejaculate like an egg. And a few other people making the frying egg analogy. So hopefully our semen caller from just before.
Well, I like my showers at 41 degrees centigrade, but 41 degrees centigrade in the brain or in your body can cook some of the proteins and damage you forever. So it could damage the semen proteins.
Chris is calling in from Ipswich. Hey, Chris.
Dr. Chris, welcome.
Hey, how you doing, doctor?
Very well. What's your question?
My question is if you can train your mind out of an irrational fear or something that you generally wouldn't be scared of.
Yes, it's difficult. It takes time. The longer you've left that fear in there, the harder it gets. I am scared of spiders called arachnophobia, and I trained myself, and now I'm at the stage where I can actually touch a photograph of a spider.
So how exactly did you do it?
Firstly I looked at photographs of spiders, and then I didn't shut the book, but I kept it open. Then I walked across, so I wasn't on the other side of the room, but actually near it. And I kept on getting closer, and then got to the stage where I can touch a photograph of a spider and not worry about it. I haven't quite got to the stage where I can touch a spider.
So it's about confronting fears.
And then doing it in graded steps. So if you think about a cardboard or a paper bag, you can burst out of it. And if you think about a hard plastic Kevlar bag, you can't. You want something that pushes you a little bit where you can just break through and you have to do more effort. So give yourself goals and keep on pushing further towards it. If it's something that interferes with your daily social life and with your activities of daily living, it's worthwhile going to see your GP and then getting a referral to a psychologist who can put you through a professional high-speed way of doing it. One way is cognitive behavior therapy. There are other ways as well.
Hey, thanks for the call, Chris.
No worries. Thanks.
Thank you, Dr. Chris.
Let's head to Matt. He's calling in from Sydney. Hey, Matt.
Hi, Dr. Matt.
Hey, Dr. Carr. How you going, mate?
Very good. Thank you.
Can I say you're a champion?
Oh, shucks. You're too kind, but thank you.
I love all your questions.
I love everything you've ever done and everything you ever will do, Matt.
Stop it, you guys.
Okay.
Cool. My question is... I always leave stuff on the back of my ute, like going to work and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to know why it stays on there. Like you could drive the whole way to work and like leave your phone on there or like a cup of coffee or I've even left my radio. And like it doesn't fall off. And,
so is this a flat back ute, but does it have a wall around it?
A little one, probably like 50 mil.
You're kidding, but, just a little ridge.
Yeah,
so it's your classic flatback. It doesn't have the proper 300 mil, foot high or 2 foot high wall.
It's just a Land Cruiser ute.
Yep.
But I always I talked to my mate Dave in Canberra who's listening at his desk right now. I said to him, I think it's like, you know how the earth pulls the moon in and the sun pulls the earth in? I said that when the car's driving, because the wheels create friction, it creates like a mini magnetic field, and then that's what halted it on there.
No, I would definitely not magnetism, definitely not gravity, but rather resonances going through the tray. Is it a factory tray or an aftermarket tray?
No, just a steel tray.
But it was supplied by the factory? Did it come that way from the... Right.
Yeah.
Now, the Japanese engineers, any of the companies, not just picking on one, tend to be fairly obsessive. And I've spoken with some of the Japanese engineers, and they go to the trouble of making sure that this sort of stuff happens. So they'll run it on a vibration pad, and then they'll run it through the Australian outback. You'll see all sorts of vehicles running through the Australian outback, and they'll test it for that sort of stuff. And then if stuff vibrates off by itself... And Baron, you should really tie it down, because if you're in a crash, something could fly off and go through somebody's head, as in that bit in the movie Gravity where something goes through one of the astronauts' head. So,
right,
and so I'd be willing to bet that they have gone to the trouble of putting some little tweaks and making sure that the resonances are stuff that nothing jumps out, because you can have resonances that things will jump out, and they will have tested it in the Australian outback and then adjusted things so it didn't jump out. So the reason it doesn't is because they've done the work. You get that with a factory tray, not with an aftermarket tray. You might be lucky, you might not be lucky.
Hey, thanks for the call, Matt.
Cool.
Thank
See
you, Matt.
See you later.
See ya.
So you've seen Gravity, Carl. A couple of weeks ago you weren't sure whether you were going to see it. Do you think it was scientifically spot on?
No, but it was a lot, but it was lots of fun. Like, for example, what is she wearing, the heroine, Sandra Bullock, when she comes out of the space? Every time she pulls herself in there, what's she wearing?
Undies and a bra.
Right. You didn't see the giant nappy that they all wear so they can have a wee and a poo.
Nor
do you see the fact that they're wearing something to control their temperature, their own personal air conditioning unit, which has, it's a thick suit, maybe a few centimetres thick, with 90 metres of hose.
Jeepers.
90 metres, that's what they're wearing. No, she just wears undies.
I would have loved it if she was just floating around in a nappy. That would have made it. That would have been like my film of the year.
Yeah.
Sandra Bullock in a nappy in space.
Yeah, but some of the science was really good. And I don't mind one bit that they made. They had to do a few adjustments to make the story go further, because you do that in real life anyway.
It was fun. Suspend
and some
reality.
Of the pictures were just great.
Well, let's talk about space.
One question. Do you think that when he came back into the spacecraft that George Clooney looked like Buzz Lightyear?
I think you've just given away a spoiler, but no, I don't think he did.
I think he even sounded like Buzz Lightyear.
I'm going to keep going before anybody who hasn't seen it gets anything else spoiled. Cody is calling in from Mount Isa with a question about space. Hey, Cody.
Hi, Dr. Cody. Welcome.
How's it going, Dr. Carl?
Very well, thank you.
Yeah, my question is do magnets work in space once we're past the magnetic field of the Earth?
Ah, the magnetic field of the Earth and the gravitational field of the Earth reach to the edge of the universe, but they drop off with the square of the distance. So if you double the distance away from the Earth, the gravitational and magnetic fields are not just half as weak, they're one quarter. If you make it 10 times further, they're not 10 times weaker, they're 100 times weaker. So they drop off pretty rapidly. The magnet itself will run anywhere, regardless of whether there's an external magnetic field or not, or whether there's an atmosphere or not. And magnetism basically kind of works thanks to the presence of unpaired electrons in the outer shells of atoms. And that's a characteristic of the magnet itself. So you can set up a totally magnetically shielded room on Earth, and then where you don't pick up the Earth's magnetic field, and then bring a fridge magnet in there, and then that will stick to another fridge magnet.
All right, that's all I wanted to know.
Thanks for the call, Cody.
Thank you, Cody.
Thank you.
Glad we could help out. Logan is calling in from Darwin this morning, 8 years old. Good morning, Logan.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
What's your question?
My question is, why are there some weights are different weights than others?
Ah, there was a Nobel Prize awarded this year for that. So you're made of atoms. Have you heard about atoms, Logan?
Yes.
Okay, well, one part of an atom is a thing called an electron, and inherently it has no mass at all by itself. It just has no mass. And then another part of the atom is the center, the nucleus, which is made of protons and neutrons, which in turn are made of smaller things called quarks. And once again, they have no mass. So we've got this weird situation, Logan, that you are made of particles, every single one of which has no mass, and yet you have a mass. And it turns out, and this is what the Nobel Prize was awarded for this year, and by the way, the saying is, if I could explain it in one sentence, it would not be worth a Nobel Prize. The reason that things have got different mass is that as they interact with the Higgs field, they interact with it differently, and this gives them different mass. So a photon, as in light, doesn't interact with the Higgs field, picks up no mass. Electrons pick up a little bit of mass. Quarks pick up a lot. The heaviest is the W boson. It picks up a lot of mass. And in the next stage, how do we stop this from happening? Maybe you could be the person to find out how to do that and then work out how to get rid of mass and give us space travel at the speed of light.
So the Higgs field is the factor that changes the mass of everything.
That gives mass to anything.
Okay.
So as something, right. The Higgs field, by the way, is everywhere and in one cubic, in the whole universe. So in one cubic meter of anything, the center of the sun, the distant stars, vacuum of space, the center of the earth, your backyard, your swimming pool, one cubic meter of anything has Higgs energy, which is equal to the total output of the sun for 1,000 years. And there's this tremendous energy all around us, and we can't tap it. Over to you, Hi. Logan. That's your job.
Thanks for the call, Logan.
Thanks.
Thank you. Make sure you get a Nobel Prize.
That's a heavy thing to say to an 8-year-old. Make sure you get a Nobel Prize.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Let him do it by the time he's 40 then, if he doesn't have to do it by high school. All right.
Pressure's on. Steve's calling in from Sydney. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Dr. Steve.
There you go.
Good, thanks. What's your question?
Look, not as quite as exciting on a Nobel Prize in inspiring, but I'd like to ask a question about car and tyre air pressures.
Mm-hmm.
I've found recently that if you run your car or your bike with about 30 psi of pressure in the tyres and continue to use those that car and the bike over that 6 to 8 week period, the pressure doesn't get lost, so mm-hmm. you don't lose the pressure. If you leave a car or a bike sitting around for that same period of time with the same pressure in it, after that time, you check those pressures, it's lost quite a bit, almost half.
Mm-hmm.
Why does it get lost when you're not using those tyres?
The rubber tyres will, in Australia's probably busiest road, which would be the Sydney Harbour Bridge, 100,000 cars a day, they would lose, crossing the Sydney Harbour Bridge, about 36 kilograms of rubber. Now, how do tyres lose rubber? And this will get us then to answer the question on why it loses pressure. One way is when you're doing a burnout, a donut, a smoker. That's not a good thing to do. Another thing is that the road is very rough, has rocks in it, and that cuts a tyre. But normally, the way that rubber is lost, and each rotation you lose one of a car tyre, you lose 1/1,000,000th of a metre of thickness, is that the rubber expands and contracts. So as it comes down to the bottom and starts to kiss the road, it contracts, and then when it lets go the road and then comes up the other side and moves towards the top of the tyre, top of the wheel, it then expands, and you get these little micro cracks. They're always opening and closing. So providing you're using the tyre, it's always opening and closing. The key point here is that they're closing. They don't get a chance to open very far before they close again. If you have a tyre just sitting on the ground, the bit where it's kissing the ground, at the boundary, so not where it's kissing the ground entirely, but the boundary between kissing the ground and not kissing the ground, the tyre is bent around a curve, the rubber will open, and it doesn't get to close again. And it will keep on opening. And that's the weak point, as far as I can tell from my reading, where the tyre pressure comes out.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks so much for the call, Steve.
Thank you very much.
We've got time for one more, and I think it's an answer. Earlier today, Alex Dyson called up from inside the Triple J offices, but he still called and asked why we have two holes. Why do we have to
wee birds have only got one
and poo when birds just do everything out of one hole?
That's right.
Miranda's calling in from Victoria, studying microbiology. Thank you for calling, Miranda.
Miranda, thank you.
Hi. I was just wanting to say that, well, women need to be sterile where the urine's coming out of.
Yep.
And, I mean, if they've got things like E. coli going there, they'll get, as you know, Dr. Carl,
yep.
UTIs. Or yep. Sorry, yeah. Urinary tract infections. And if they get chronic ones, it can actually go to the kidneys, up the ureters, and that'll cause really, really bad problems. Also, when it comes to babies and having babies, birds, they lay eggs. So they're, right? We don't really have that. We don't do that. So everything goes on in our uterus. And if things like, bacteria can cross the placenta, it will actually cause congenital defects, maybe.
Okay, so getting back to birds, do birds have an anatomical pathway which allows fecal bacteria from their excretory tract, so they're eating food and they squirt out the other end, can it possibly then go up what they have for kidneys? Now, I understand they've got different kidneys from us and they don't want to be carrying around a bladder, so they just actually concentrate everything down so it comes out virtually as a solid mass. Does this then mean, because they've got a solid mass coming down a pipe, do they have a separate ureter coming out of their kidney? And is this ureter sort of blocked in such a way as to stop the upward flow of bacteria, which could then knock off the kidney?
For birds?
Yeah.
I wouldn't know.
No, that's a question.
No, I wouldn't know. Oh, is that his question?
Yeah.
Sorry.
But thanks for all your knowledge
that's
as well.
Okay.
And passing it on.
Cheers.
And people don't know
thought,
that.
Yep.
Cheers for the call, Miranda.
Okay, bye.
Thank you.
I also wanted to share a few other people texting in on 0439757555 on the subject of the Higgs field. Mm. People saying Yoda called it the Force, so they've decided it's the Force.
Yes.
You happy with that?
I like the Force. May the Force be with you. So that's for everybody who's born on the 4th of May each year.